Good morning. I think we'll get started. Welcome to the new, improved, and renovated Dawson Auditorium. This project was a long time coming, but as you'll probably agree with me, they did a really nice job. This morning, I'd like to introduce Manny Emmanuel Markakis, who received his Bachelor of Science in Biology from Florida State and his Doctor of Pharmacy from Nova Southeastern College of Pharmacy. He has faculty appointments at Nova Southeastern School of Pharmacy. He's assistant professor of pharmacy practice at Palm Beach Atlantic College of Pharmacy and a clinical assistant professor at FAU College of Medicine, where he's adjunct faculty. He's managed the clinical pharmacy services here at Boca Regional in the PGY1 residency program, director of Boca Regional Hospital. He's lectured and presented and published numerous papers. This morning's topic is the role of biosimilar medications in clinical practice. Please join me in welcoming Manny.
Good morning. Thank you, Dr. Rosenthal. So, again, another pharmacy-type lecture for you all. But I think this is extremely important because it is some of the, it's really the new wave of medication development that's happening. There's been a lot of changes, and you're going to see as we go through this talk today how the process of biosimilars gets developed and in comparisons to biological medications, and we'll look and compare that to generics, because as physicians, you're all going to be hit with that. Especially if you're in some of the topics or in the areas of diseases that I'm going to be presenting to you today. A little disclaimer, this is not going to be a discussion of the specific biological or biosimilars that are out there, because a lot of them are just essentially existing. They've been in existence for a while. So this topic is not going to discuss. We're going to look at which ones are currently available or and approved and the ones that are forthcoming, but there's not going to be a typical pharmacology talk on those medications, because essentially they are biosimilars to what already exists out there today. So with that, we'll go ahead and get started. And, you know, we'll start off with you probably can't read it in the back, but this was, as I was doing some research, this little cartoon thing came up, and it looked pretty kind of funny. It was appropriate for today's talk. And the title is Identity Crisis, because, and here let me explain a little bit. What we have is a kind of like a therapist or a psychiatrist or some sort of therapist, and we have a little duck here that is getting, that apparently needs some help. So the bottom line says, well, you certainly walk like a duck and quack like a duck, therefore, yes, you probably still are a duck. And hopefully that will make a little bit more sense as we go through on these slides. So here's some of the objectives that we are going to talk about today, and I'll let you read those, but we're going to really move towards what these biosimilars are and why they even exist. We're going to look at the different manufacturing techniques between biologics and typical chemical non-biological medications. And we're going to outline strategies, more importantly for you, outline strategies for physicians in your practice on regarding biosimilar medications and the way that you all will make decisions in your practice, which ones to use. Some cases you may have a choice, and other cases you may not really have a choice. So we'll talk about that as well. We will get into future biosimilar medications. We're going to look and see what's in the pipeline. We're going to see that the biosimilars take a while to develop, and you'll see with some of the pending dates. In fact, much of the dates are kind of estimates. They're not even actual dates because there's so many lawsuits that are going on right now. And I'm actually going to touch in a little bit about why there are so many lawsuits with biosimilars as they come out to marketplace with the parent company. So we'll get into some of that. We have to really define what biosimilars are. So this is the textbook biosimilar definition, which is a follow-on biologic that meets, and I emphasize, extremely high standards for comparability to an originator or parent biological drug and has no clinical This is the important part, too. It has no clinical meaningful differences in safety, purity, and potency. So it basically kind of sounds what it sounds like. It's essentially a copy of what is out there right now. There's no differences in efficacy. There's not supposed to be any safety differences, purity. So sounds too good to be true, right? So we'll get into that a little bit, right? Well, let's start right now. They have to be similar in nature. The FDA, when they look at these drugs that are produced, there are many categories of elements of approval within the approval system, and we'll talk about that. They have to be similar in nature in terms of quality, safety, and efficacy compared to the innovator. And it's important to know that these are not generics. It's not filed as a generic. It's filed under a completely different pathway, which I'll go over with you all. But they are not generics. They can come out much sooner than when generics are allowed to come out. There are different requirements for proof of worthiness. Again, it has to be. It's really kind of a funny relationship. We'll get into that with the parent compound, if you will. That's the originator. I kind of interchange them. I might interchange them both within today's lecture between parent compound and innovator. And the only reason that they were allowed to be produced is for price competition with the parent drug. You'll not see these drugs with other typical chemical-related drugs that are on the market. I don't even think there is one available. I think they're all in injectable form right now, and I'm not even aware that any oral biosimilars are actually being in development. So they're all injectable at this point. And what's interesting is finding out why this even came about. So what was the whole reason for it? And I told you for price competition, but where did it originate from? And, you know, as I got into more material here, it's like, well, what's the whole purpose of it? Well, this might be familiar to you. The Biologics Price Competition and Innovation Act of 2009. It was part of the Affordable Health Care Act. And it was signed into law in March 23rd, 2010. And it created a biosimilar pathway application. It's not necessarily a curtailing of, it's not a fast-tracked pathway. It's not like a generic when it comes out. That's what it is. It's got to be, it only has to show bioequivalence. There are some elements, as I previously mentioned, that have to be involved in the approval process. But the 351K pathway, which I'll get into a little bit more, is how a company can file for a biosimilar to be developed today. This act also granted the FDA to approve highly similar versions of previously approved biologics. So if a biologic is still in patent and it's still brand, and it's been brand for X amount of years, we'll get into that in a sec, in a little while too, it allows a company, and not just a generic company, it could be a top-notch pharmaceutical company, to file, in some cases, interestingly enough, competition with itself. So if its brand drug name is going off patent soon, it can file for its own biosimilar to kind of keep up with higher pricing, if you will, before the generic comes out. It's somewhat of an abbreviated process, but they must, again, I will emphasize, they have to demonstrate to the FDA safety, purity, and potency. And what's interesting is, if in the second to last bullet point kind of requires a little bit of a background, you know that a drug patent is held for 20 years after the drug is actually filed. Not when it's marketed, but when it's filed. So from the time that it's filed with the FDA, no other copies can be made whatsoever, technically for 20 years. Now, think about it. How long does it take a drug to get approved once after a filing? It could be years, because then you have to go through clinical trials. You have to go through phase one through three clinical trials. And then so there are some drugs that don't get approved until 6 or 7 years after the drug has been filed with the FDA. So then once it's launched, now you've got, 12 to 13 some odd years that the company can sell the drug, et cetera. So remember, it's 20 years for a patent to be expiring, but that's from drug application, not actually launch, okay? And it has to be the same FDA indications as the brand product. So I just provided a little copy Basically, I summarized through here. You can certainly look up that reference yourself, but keep in mind that it was part of the Affordable Health Care Act. And so what is the FDA doing? The FDA has goals, and they want to be able to look at 70% of applications. The goal is to look at 70% of applications for biosimilars within 10 months of receipt in fiscal years 13 and 14, 80% in 2015, et cetera. And as you can see, the FDA is kind of anticipating looking at so many of these biologics. So they're going to be busy not looking at the typical oral tablets. They're going to be busy looking more at the highly cost drugs that are affecting healthcare today. So here is a copy of a slide from the approval process. You could see that the 351K is where everything goes through for a biological or a biosimilar product to be filed. They do have clinical studies, again, but they're not required to do efficacy studies. They're allowed to look at the safety and make sure they're only required to look at safety, purity, manufacturing techniques, et cetera, and file those with the FDA. But at the end of the day, it is still the same chemical, and that's kind of where the take-home point is going to be later on. This is the biological license application. This is different. The application requirements are full evaluation, purity, safety, and potency. So we just a little bit of history here. We used to have, we'll differentiate, we used to have Granix as our GCSF here, right? Everybody remembers Granix? Granix was technically not a biosimilar. It filed under this pathway, so it needed its own, even though it was a major competitor to Neupogen, but it did not file as a biosimilar. It went through the extra miles to get approval as a different drug, and thus it only had one indication. It only got approved for one indication, although therapeutically it was used for pretty much everything that Neupogen was. So when drugs and biosimilars are filed this way, most of the time they are going to get the same indications as the parent drug. But the 351K pathway is what needs to be emphasized. Now it's time to talk about what areas these biosimilars are impacting. Well, you can see right here, and I will tell you, working in inpatient care, where we see most come out is in cancer, because most of the biologics that we dispense are obviously in cancer patients, and right here, inflammatory bowel disease or GI, things like that. So there are some biosimilars coming out to treat Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, et cetera. But right now, most of them are certainly within the cancer arena. And essentially, you have to know first, before you can really apply the knowledge of a biosimilar, you have to know what biological medications are. So, again, I said biosimilars are essentially copies of biological medications. So what really are biological medications? And you can see through here, they are medical products, obviously. They are not made as from chemical reactions like the traditional ones. They're actually made from sugars, proteins, nucleic acids, huge complex. They're large molecules. I'll actually show you one in a second. They may be living entities such as cells or tissues, and we'll see some sources of those in a second. Very obvious, like drugs, the biological products can treat disease. They diagnose diseases, they prevent diseases, etc. We're actually there's some drugs now that harnessed live herpes cells in order to treat advanced stages of melanoma. So they're engineered to really target receptors, but they come from different types of living tissue. And you can see here's a nice little graph about how complex. Here's a little aspirin right here. Simple. Probably the most common drug taken in the world today. Little aspirin here. And this is an example of how complex biological medications are and how they're developed. These are just atoms, et cetera. But the scope of these biological medications is grand. They're expensive to make. They're expensive to obtain. And they get expensive to patients. So here's an example. Here's a picture of what a biological medication plant looks like, and we'll show you another version in a second. But you can see no way is this much machinery required to make a typical chemical drug, but certainly for a biological drug where you're taking cells, you're harvesting them, you're creating them, you're adding certain stabilizers to them, and you're actually using them to target certain areas on whatever efficacy is required. But it is truly a complex process. And you can see that some of these boilers right here is kind of what this is. This is a more simplified graph, but you can see that there's a that live cells go into a fermentation process, and then the protein mixture gets harvested, and then there is a purification component to it. There is concentration of isolation of the actual drug once it's made, and then there's formulation filling, and then lo and behold, you actually get, well, you get the biological drug substance, and then you get fillers for more stabilization, and then you get the biological drug product. I just made that extremely simple. You probably don't get it, but that's probably the simplest way to do that. But the bottom line is it starts from live cells. There's purification. And what's interesting about biological medications is, do you think that you can actually have the same levels of purification? We're talking brand name now. Same levels and amounts of purification, and every product comes out exactly the same way? The answer is no. And there are quality standards that pharmaceutical companies have in order to make biological medications as pure as possible. So they go through testing. They don't get released until they pass their own internal testing. So whereas typical drugs, Protonix, aspirin, things like that, they're all made the same way because they're chemical. They're made from chemical reactions. These are not only made from chemical reactions. They have to go through purification processes and their own standards before they are released. So that's the difference between a typical medication and a biological medication being released. You may not be happy with some of this, but this is not even biosimilars. This is biological medications in general. Okay, here are some of the sources that you get. We can get sources from humans, depends on the company and the drug, of course. Birds, transgenics, there's a sheep there, apparently. Yeast, plant culture, insect. Look at all these sources, okay? So with that comes, obviously, a risk in biologics on immunogenicity. And there are immunogenicity studies because we don't want to create antibodies for depending on the source. So that's why sometimes, like with the flu vaccine, for instance, you know, patients that have certain allergies to some of this, for example, eggs, whatever, they're not capable of receiving those vaccines because they are considered biologics as well, in case you didn't know. So many different types of sources. Some might surprise you. A lot of bacteria DNA is involved in making these biological medications. So a little bit of facts on biologics, which is kind of transitioning why biosimilars are going to be a player in the marketplace. Although they account for less than 1% of all prescriptions, they constitute almost between a quarter and one-third of all prescription drug spending. So they're not the highest of volume out in the marketplace, but they're certainly the most costly medications that patients have to get. The interesting facts, it's predicted to increase by 20% rate per year. There's a lot of money invested in production of biological medications. There's a need for it if we're trying to transition. We'll use cancer as an example. Biological medications are keeping patients longer, living longer, although not tremendously longer, but they are keeping them longer. And the people, patients and families find value in that. So there is a demand for biological medications. Whether you think it's worth living another 2 to 3 months based on an expensive biologic, it means a whole lot of difference in patients and families. By 2025, more than 70% of new drug approvals will be biologics. I think that's going to be more than that by 2025. Because who knows where the next set I know gene therapy was in the works for a while. I'm not really sure where that is, but biologics definitely are not going away. And I think there's, based on my research, I think it's going to be more, a little bit more. It's probably closer to 80-some%. Look at the projected sales, if you can read this. Some of these, I'm not sure. Here's Rituxan, for example. Here's Lantus. Here is Gilead, Humira, etc. Look at all these in billions. By 2020, global sales up for the top 2015 drugs. A tremendous amount of sales. And that's pretty, that, in my opinion, again, I think it's a little bit conservative. I think it's going to be a little bit higher than that. So you could see down here, Avastin, Roche's Avastin, Herceptin, etc. Remicade, there's Remicade, $5.9 billion, etc. So again, the way that these biological medications work, the way that they're applied, they are used in very important diseases, of course, to be treated. But you could see this is leading to one of the reasons why we have to have biosimilars. The need for biosimilars is multifactorial, but if you think about it, the high cost of R&D, research and development, leads to high cost to patients. So as these biological medications are being produced, again, not only is it expensive to produce, it's expensive to conduct clinical trials for the parent compound, for the parent company. Many patients are subsidized by federal and state programs. So what that simply means is, programs like Medicaid, for example, patients' assistance. So if you have a Humira patient, for example, that can't afford it, you know, they're not insured, guess what happens? The company ends up subsidizing a lot of that, and then that just leads to a whole vicious cycle because then the prices go up and et cetera. So a lot of folks are paying for these expensive biologics when the patients really can't even afford it. So it's a burden. The government looks at this as a burden for taxpayers. So that's why part of the Affordable Health Care Act was a biological license pathway to really help minimize that and drive a little bit more competition from a price perspective. I kind of just talked about the last point, incentive for price control in the marketplace in the marketplace before the patent expires. Again, it's not generic. This could be done right when, I'll get you the specifics in a second. So a little bit of a comparison. Let's change over from generics to biosimilars. Here's a table that looks at some of the key attributes for generics. Essentially, if you look at indications, when generic products come out for biosimilars, they are the same as the brand indications. For biosimilars, they may not have the same as brand. Price discounts was another important factor in there. Once generics, although it's really funny, when Lovenox became generic at one point, for some reason, it was a little bit more expensive than Sanofi's Lovenox. It was kind of funny. So over time, as more players come into the marketplace in generics, then the prices drop. But for the first 6 months to a year, you really don't see that effect until more players are in the marketplace. So what's interesting is, what role does the parent compound company have? They have no role whatsoever in generics, but you might find this a little bit comical that there is a significant role in the biosimilar competitor. We'll talk about that. So in other words, the parent company, before it goes generic, has a say in what the company that's trying to produce the biosimilar has in. So keep that in mind. Where do biosimilars start? Well, Europe, right? All drugs get approved in Europe first, and then it takes years and years sometimes before drugs get approved in the United States. But it all generates from Europe, because the Europeans have more of a, obviously, socialized medicine approach to it, but biosimilars were licensed and began in the European Union. So the EMA started years ago, in 2004, was put into legislation, and you could see some of the early biosimilar diseases and that were affected by this act. Insulin, human growth hormone, drugs like Neupogen, erythropoietins, interferon. So those were some of the first drugs that were approved for biosimilars in Europe. And then eventually some of those have come over to the United States. And it's interestingly enough, two applications for the biosimilar for Remicade have been filed with the EMA. And I'll give you an update on that in the United States in a few minutes. But point is, like most other drugs and pipelines in production, it all starts in Europe, and it took us a little while to kind of figure out, hey, is this going to work in the United States? So that's what is really happening right now. So Europe started all this. And you could see there are some examples of various, not only that, And by the way, for biosimilars, it's not just one company that can make a biosimilar. There could be multiple companies making biosimilars. So that the goal is to drive competition even further. So to drive prices down. So it's not just one parent biosimilar. Multiple companies can make biosimilars for one drug, which is what is illustrated in this particular graph. And I kind of had to cut and paste a little bit. But you could see, look at all these that are in Europe for Neupogen. This is the equivalent of Neupogen, if you will, the filgrastim. You could see the different types of companies that are in Europe that are making biosimilars. So really it's about what's the lowest price, who's going to get the lowest bid type of thing. And that's really what the intent is in here in the United States. Hopefully that's, that's one of the goals that are hopeful for the Affordable Health Care Act. And here's a couple more, growth hormones. There's an insulin, et cetera. There's a glargine. This is the name of the Eli Lilly biosimilar for the Lantus that we have. There's some monoclonal antibodies. Here's what Inflectra is, the Remicade, and Remisma is also. There's two different Remicades in Europe, and one of those is actually being filed here in the United States. So it all starts with Europe, folks. So where are we at right now? There's only one true biosimilar that is available in the United States, not necessarily approved, we'll get into that in a second, but that you can commercially buy right now, and that is Zarzio. And we converted to Zarzio back in July. I think we implemented that sometime in July, maybe the second week or so. The Zarzio is basically the Neupogen. We had, as I mentioned, we had Granix. We moved from Granix to, from Neupogen brand, because it was brand, still not generic, to Granix. And then when the biosimilar came out, we did our homework on that end, and then we went and did that automatic interchange to Zarzio. Again, my point about Granix, it was not filed under the same pathway as the biosimilar pathway. Even though we kind of treated it as a biosimilar, it did have clinical efficacy studies associated, I think only one though, clinical efficacy study associated with the Granix. So, but that was good enough for us and the medical staff and those that were, at the end of the day, it's still GCSF. So that was one of the important things. And they both compete with the Neupogen. Now, again, an update. So here's where we're at presently. Notice the nomenclature. So here's the brand name and here's the chemical name. And right now this is kind of confusing. I'm not really sure if the laws are going to continue this way, but you have to provide somewhere the chemical name with a dash and an abbreviation of the company that makes it. So that's unusual. Like if you go into CPOE and you're trying to type up, you're looking for filgrastim or Zarzio, you might see that in there. So the nomenclature. So that's what the national drug code, the NDC code, is tied to, this particular name. So you can see there is Remicade, there is Enbrel, and there's Humira. That's what the biosimilar names are. They are approved in the United States, but they're not really launched yet, only with the exception of Zarzio. Well, what does this all mean? Are we expected to, what kind of savings are we looking at? If all the patients get converted over to a biosimilar, these are some of the numbers that you can see. This red graph, here's the projected spend. The red graph is with biosimilars, and you could see starting essentially in 2019, you could start seeing the savings go up, the expected savings with the biosimilar. So $250 billion is projected in savings just from 11 biosimilars when they come up. That's a tremendous amount. So if the same efficacy can be given with safety, and you could save $250 billion, that seems like a kind of a win-win situation for a lot of patients. And insurance plans are going to be paying attention to a lot of this, so which is part of my comments for later on. Legislature. So there's a lot of lobbying for this, and I don't know too much about this, to be honest with you. I'm not going to disclose my political beliefs, obviously, because I've had enough of that with my own family, I'm sure, as well as you have as well. But here's the thing. There are lobbying forums that are for biosimilars. So it's not just a small mom-and-pop shop that's actually making biosimilars. These are pretty powerful companies that are making them, and they have lobbying going on presently a nonprofit group that will lobby for how biosimilars are used in the United States. And drugs and drug manufacturers like Hospira, Pfizer. Pfizer's a brand company, right? One of the top companies. They're going to get into the biosimilar business. They have a generic portfolio. They have a generic division, so there are Pfizer generics. They have Pfizer brands. Now they're going to have Pfizer biosimilar division. So it's in their best interest to do that. Not really sure what Samsung is doing in the drug business, especially with the problems that they've had with their batteries. I promise you, if we ever evaluate a Samsung drug, I'll make sure that it doesn't catch on fire, you know, things like that. When our team will be heavily invested in that. So keep in mind that a dozen makers of biosimilars collectively have formed what's called the Biosimilars Forum. You can look at that yourself if you want, but it's basically a huge lobbying on how biosimilars are going to be approached. So keep that in mind. The development comes as the FDA has a number of biosimilars currently under consideration. So there are lots on the FDA's plate right now. The FDA is not so much looking. Think about it. When was the last, I think the last major class of drugs that had been approved were some of the anticoagulants, and there's some drugs now to treat, some tablets now to treat hyperkalemia that have come out. But there's really not any blockbuster, regular, traditional medications that have come out. Everything you see on TV is what? You see Humira, and why do you think they're doing that? Because they know that the biosimilars are really kind of nipping at them a little bit. So you see a lot of biological commercials that are out there. The Humiras, the Stelaras, anything that ends with a mab is pretty much biological. So I'll just give you a clue on that. By 2019, and this was a survey that was done last year at the American Society of Health System Pharmacists, which is our major conference and seminar. From a pharmacy forecast perspective, from 2015 to 2019, there was a survey that was done that wanted to evaluate how are hospitals and pharmacies really looking at the biosimilars. And how important is it to you? How important is it to the institutions that you work at? So here are some of the results. At least 50%, you'll be able to see that. At least 50% of the health systems would have implemented a process for adding a biosimilar to the formularies and for monitoring their utilization. So 58% said very likely, yes, we are going to incorporate a system to evaluate biosimilars, whether it's direct interchangeability, and that depends on the state, and I'll show you that in a second, or what. So how are we addressing it? Yes, 58% said yes, they're very, very likely to address it. 41%, somewhat likely, we'll wait. I'll deal with it when it gets to me, when it comes out, when prices change, reimbursement changes, etc. So I'm somewhat likely. It's on the table, it's just not on the top priority radar. Somewhat unlikely and very unlikely, as you could see, almost none. So at some point, I mean, everybody is going to be having to evaluate, the pharmacies and the organizations are going to be having some sort of plan to evaluate this. So it is something that's very serious. Interpreting state legislation related to biologics. This is a graph that you can find online. But if you look at the states that are colored, enacted for biosimilar substitution, the states that are in green have put in a law that says and that recognizes biosimilars, generics, brands are essentially interchangeable. And notice Florida. We're green. We're right in there. The places that are red, they were filed, but they failed. So the places in red do not look at them as interchangeable for whatever reason. And I don't know those reasons, but just to give you a graph, certainly Florida, where we are, obviously, the state of Florida has identified those as completely interchangeable. Well, it's a fight to the end. I'm setting this up here. I'm setting the scene. There's a major fight that's going to happen. And guess what? There are lawsuits going on right now. And even though a drug, as I previously mentioned, gets approved by the FDA, there are certain things that took me about 10 times to read to even just get remote steps that remotely the steps that have to be taken. It can be dragged out in courts. So even though it's ready to go, it's approved, sometimes it's not launched for a couple of years. So, and that's the way that the brand companies can, patent companies can keep their products going. So they can stop the launch even though it's approved by the FDA. So you're not going to see this. I'll kind of highlight. I wrote some notes down here to make sure that I get the, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I will paraphrase. So within 20 days, here's the filing of the BLA, the 351K. After 20 days of accepting a biosimilar application for review, the process must be provided to the reference product sponsor and patent owner. That simply means, here, I'm filing for a biosimilar. Here you go, patent drug. I'm going to kind of start ripping you off here soon, but here's what we're doing. So what happens then is, within this time frame, and I'll paraphrase, and this is what? This is like a six-month time frame. The biosimilar company says, no, I'm sorry, before that, the parent company says, okay, you filed for a biosimilar for my product. Here's what I think your indication should be. They have 60 days to do that. Then the biosimilar kind of goes back and forth and says, no, we don't want that. We want all six of your indications. That happens within the 120 days. Then 60 days later, the brand company says, no, you're not going to get all six, and here is why. So they go a lot. So within 6 months, they go back and forth till eventually, at some point, there's a lawsuit. They can block the injunction. They can block the patent. So sometimes that's why I said it may have the same indications as the parent compound because it's not guaranteed in law. The depends on what's won in court. Okay? So the whole thing about the Zarzio with Sandoz, they won everything, so they do get this. They have the same indications as Neupogen. Just happened to be that way. So it's a battle. It goes back and forth, and that adds to cost, right? So keep that in mind. So there's lawsuits, and what are the lawsuits that are currently going on? I thought it might be interesting to you. For pegfilgrastim, the pegfilgrastim that we use, Amgen makes Neulasta. And Apotex has got a biosimilar for Neulasta out there. And that's going on right now. And this is as recent as October, the end of October this year. Here's one. This is the one for the Remicade. So Janssen and Celltrion, which is what got approval for Remicade here in the United States, the biosimilar for Remicade, that's going on in court right now. Probably in these phases over here, the negotiations for court. So we don't know when that's going to, we don't know anything that's going to be, when they're going to be launched. So here's another one. Again, here's another one for regular Aranesp, Amgen's Aranesp. There's Hospira is making a biosimilar for Aranesp, and that's now in court. And here's one for Humira, AbbVie, who makes Humira. Amgen is a brand company. It's not a generic company. Amgen is a huge company, and they want to make a biosimilar to Humira. So again, it's not these little small companies that are trying to make biosimilars. It's the big ones because they sense sales in there. And the last one, this is regarding Merck now is trying to get into a biosimilar for Lantus, because Lantus is a biological. So Sanofi, which makes Lantus, is in suit now with Merck still. So we don't know. I don't know where they're at now at present day. But eventually you'll see something in Wall Street Journal or whatever medical journals that you all have. So kind of wrapping up towards the end here, I'm not sure I was perfectly clear on this, but a biosimilar cannot be filed until 4 years after. It can't be approved, let's put it this way, it can't be approved until the parent company, the brand company, has been out in the market for 12 years. So you could start the process now, right? So they could start, they can file 4 years after the parent company has filed for the biosimilar, but it can't be approved until 12 years after. So the parent companies are making, they've had 12 years to do all their profits, et cetera, and recoup the money from R&D. So it cannot be approved for 12 years. So now, once there's a biological medication that has a niche that gets filed 4 years later, there could be a biosimilar for it, but it can't be approved. It can be ready to go. But it can't be approved for at least 12 years, and then you've got that whole duking it out back and forth kind of thing. So it takes a long time for biosimilar to get to market. The filing is just a little bit more abbreviated. So formulary management. So what are the things, what are hospitals doing? And we're going to get what we're, our position here at Boca Regional Hospital. Here's what we have to ask ourselves, and you all in your private practices. Will the biosimilar product be endorsed for the labeled indication or for off-label indications as well? You have to think about those things. What is the existing level of ADRs with the originator product? So will that, in other words, if there's a high incidence of whatever with a particular brand product, is the biosimilar expected to have the same? That should be a consideration. And there will be data for all that stuff, as well as I previously mentioned in some of the trials. What's the approval history of the biosimilar? How long did it take to get approval? Was it denied first, then was it resubmitted, and then reapproved later on? Those are some of the things we look at. What information is available concerning the clinical efficacy and safety of the biosimilar? Another thought. FDA review documents, whether published trials, European data, expert organizational guidelines. So those are resources that you can use whether to decide or not to go ahead and use a biosimilar for a particular biological product. So all this information, right, you kind of got a little snapshot of what we had been trying to look at for the last several months. And when we presented the biosimilars, I presented an abbreviated, obviously, version of this for our Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee. And after the data and the methods of some of the how biosimilars are made, et cetera, it was approved that we consider, along with the state of Florida, interchangeable. And the medical staff approved it at the med exec level. But we had to look at any clinical trials. We didn't just rubber stamp it. Something comes out. No, we don't rubber stamp it. We looked at everything. We looked at some of the trials and see if there was any adverse safety events associated with it. We factored in interchangeability, as I told you. Cost and also reimbursement is a big factor. Reimbursement now, especially with some of these drugs, because most of these biologicals, if you've not had a call from the pharmacy that with that famous call, sorry, doctor, this drug is for outpatient only. That's because, for obvious reasons, that the reimbursement is completely different than reimbursement on the inpatient side, right? But reimbursement is a huge factor because now, and I'll use Neupogen for an example, between Neupogen, Granix, and the Zarzio, we looked at, because most of that stuff is used as an outpatient, a lot of that stuff is used as an outpatient, particularly with the CHO, we all looked at that together, CHO and the hospital, and we all decided based on the cost, based on the and reimbursement, that the Zarzio was the best fit. So that's why we converted all the patients over to Zarzio, because we have a significant amount of filgrastim use on the outside. So, and I'm sure that's what other hospitals and are going to be looking at as well, is many of these factors here. So most P&Ts will be looking at this, whether or not it makes sense for the organization. Again, I talked about Granix, although this is what it looked like. It was approved after full drug review with interchange from Neupogen in late 2013. It wasn't filed as a biological, but it was kind of it actually took a little longer than a traditional biosimilar to come out, but the price was better than Neupogen because Neupogen was brand. So we went with that, and we had fine results with it. I kind of talked about this already. The biosimilars was presented at March of 2015, approving all biosimilars as interchangeable, approved by medical staff. That includes when these drugs come out as generics. So when a drug comes out on generic, it can have a brand, a biosimilar, and a generic, and basically the pharmacy would be just making those conversions based, unless something new has come out in literature, we'll always do our homework, we would interchange between the three of those. And I suspect, from a practice perspective, the insurance companies will follow that as well. Summarizing, we do have a, and it's not just us that's that feels the same way about it. Vizient, who is our GPO, the largest GPO in the United States, which is where our contracts are often when we buy drugs, they also awarded this to Zarzio as well. So from a local hospital to a national contract level, it was awarded, the Zarzio was awarded to for them as well. And now when you look in CPOE, you can't type in Neupogen. It's not going to be there. I think if you type in filgrastim, you'll see the Zarzio come up, but you have to type purposefully Zarzio or filgrastim in order to get the biosimilar that's out there. It's the only option in CPOE right now and for both inpatient and of course we interchange any outpatient Neupogen to Zarzio. And that's kind of what it looks like. This is just the one strength. It's the 300. It also comes in obviously in a 480 as well. The dosings are the same, whether it's a microgram per kilogram or straight, I think it's 5 or 10 microgram per kilogram or straight 300 or 480 micrograms. So they all come in the same form. You really don't even see, you won't even miss it, to be honest with you. So projected U.S. patent expiration dates for biosimilars. Here you go. Neupogen, potential biosimilar entry. Again, I'm not going to hold these dates, even though they say projected, because they could be tied up in lawsuits, etc. You'll see here Avastin, Aranesp, Enbrel, some of the stuff that we've talked about already. And the future, you're not going to be able to see this, but again, the point is the reference, there's going to be more biologicals that are coming out, more biosimilars coming out. There's going to be more companies making the same biosimilar to hopefully drive price competition low. The future, here's some more that we not talked about. Tysabri is going to have a biosimilar. Will not approve the BLA before November 16th. Lucentis for diabetic retinopathy, macular diseases. There's one for Stelara for Crohn's and psoriasis. You could see that in 2021, because this is a relatively new one. You'll see in 2021, the FDA will not approve a BLA before 2021. There's Soliris. Soliris is extremely expensive. It's not very common to have patients with PNH and atypical hemolytic uremic syndrome, but we do have some patients that are on, I think it's like every other week or a week, I'm not sure. It's either weekly or every other week. But there will not be a BLA for that until March 2019. And forget when a generic comes out, it's going to be years even further. So that's some of the closer ones, if you will, that are coming out. Impact on physicians, wrapping it up here. Hopefully in some way, I've at least introduced to you what biosimilars are, and you're more comfortable with the process of the development, the struggles in launching, etc. But you really need to know the process and feel confident in the prescribing of the biosimilars. And again, more importantly, understand how hospitals that you're practicing at, how the formulary decisions are being made when it comes to biosimilars. So whether it's here in Boca, you already know how we're treating it here in Boca. If you go to other facilities, I'm not sure how they're all treating it, but certainly you need to be inquiring if there is a biosimilar that your facility has. It's because they probably have done their homework, just like we have here. Insurance companies will likely favor biosimilars if there is no generic available. That makes sense. Even though there's probably about a 15 to 20% reduction in price, and that's just on average, depending on contracts, because these biosimilars will contract. The biosimilar companies will definitely contract. You're not going to see a 50% price reduction. It's not going to be half price. It's probably going to be maybe, you know, two-thirds price, etc. Hospitals will have in CPOE systems the biosimilar name and not the original brand name. So in most cases, we'll switch back and forth. If Neupogen ever has a generic, we'll be reevaluating that. But you typically won't see Neupogen as brand when you type in CPOE. You probably have to go filgrastim, et cetera, if you're not sure which product we carry or what other hospitals carry. So in summary, biosimilars are here to stay, folks. They're here to stay. They're going to impact you. You have to be a little bit, now that you know about the differences between the biosimilars and generics and brand, now you can make better informed consent for your consideration for your patients when they're asking, what is this? I got Humira, now this is something else. Now you and your teams can be able to explain to patients, if you choose that route, what the differences are. Florida has deemed biosimilars interchangeable. Physicians will have to understand the role of biosimilars in their practice, and insurances may actually help dictate that for you. And hospital pharmacies will determine which forms of the drug to have based on previously things that we mentioned, safety, efficacy, and reimbursement. And essentially, that's it. Any questions? Yes, Dr. Babick.
Two questions. One, what is the savings for, let's just take Neupogen, what's the savings in the hospital you've noticed 30%? And then when you look at other countries, you know, like Germany buys the drug, Canada buys the drug, China buys the drug, what kind of price variation do you see across the whole world in terms of a drug like Neupogen, the biosimilar?
Well, let's start with the second question first, because we all know that the price of drugs here in the United States is high anyway. It's much higher. They're buying it cheaper. You know, we do, most of the drug companies here, don't forget, there's a Merck Europe, and then there's a Merck, well, I know Merck doesn't make it, but I'm saying, example, there's a Merck Europe division, a Merck US division. The research and development for Europe, Merck, for example, is done here mostly. Okay, in the United States. Most of the R&Ds are done here just because they're launched over there. They're collaborating with the United States. So it's more expensive to do R&D here. So that's why those drugs prices are much more costly in the United States compared to the Canadians buying them or producing them or selling them, whatever. Does that answer your question?
I'm looking at the percentage variation of the price.
Oh, it could be... The research that I've, I'll get to that one too from here, but I'll tell you, we're probably saving.
Across the world, Neupogen now has been out there, and so what's the price variation of Neupogen across the world?
Compared to here, it's about 50% cheaper outside of the United States, at least 50% based on my research, and as a class of biologics in general too. But here in the United States, or excuse me, here at Boca, when we went to Zarzio because of the contracting, we're saving 100 some thousand, but we're gaining more on the reimbursement side because the reimbursement's a lot better than Neupogen or Granix as an outpatient. So we're getting a better price, outgoing flow of cash. We're actually getting better reimbursement. Any other questions? Yes?
We're doing a lot of biosimilar research in our office for rheumatoid arthritis. We have the Humira versus biosimilar. The question, I don't really think they're interchangeable, the drugs. They're not. It's not molecule for molecule, the same drug, so it's not interchangeable. The other thing, I think the insurance companies are going to dictate what we do, because you have somebody doing well on Humira, biosimilar comes out, I'm not going to switch somebody who's doing well on one drug because the biosimilar. Maybe we'll start on the biosimilar. But taking somebody who's doing well on one drug to switch them over there, unless the drugs are so expensive, the insurance companies are going to dictate what we need.
I probably would pay attention to kind of the second comment that you had. It's going to be dictated. I'm sure there's going to be clauses for medical necessity, et cetera. And by the way, I don't know of any clinical trials that are out there from a safety and efficacy that are looking at the biosimilars versus the brand, because it's – well, that's good, because it's going to be the kiss of death for somebody, right? If there's an efficacy and safety problem with a biosimilar or with the brand, it's going to be the kiss of death for one company or another. So I think that's – going to be the next phase as more of these biosimilars come out. There's going to be some independent research for that. But again, insurance, like you said, insurances are definitely going to be impacting what, and without a notice too. The patients will come up, where's my Humira? Oh, it was denied because now you're going to be using whatever the other one is called. So the practices have to be kind of prepared for that, in my opinion, your practices. Any other comments? Thank you very much.